Hey, Lisa.
Hey, baby.
I wanted to bring you in here while I was doing the intro to this podcast because when I told you the guest, you had an emotional reaction quite a bit more extreme than most guests that when you find out who the guest is, you're like, oh, that's cool.
Yes.
When I told you that Jennifer Knapp was going to be on this podcast, it was more than that.
What?
And apparently, Jenny, Mike's wife, had a similar reaction. Jenny doesn't listen to this podcast, but when she found out Jennifer Knapp was going to be on here, she might listen to her first Liturgist podcast. We'll see. But I wanted to bring you in for this introduction because apparently Jennifer Knapp means a lot to a lot of people out there.
Yes.
You know, I liked her music, but you seem to have some sort of connection with it that seemed really deep.
Well, Jennifer was like, for me, I feel like her music was really, it was raw and honest and vulnerable in an industry that often can cover up vulnerability. Jennifer was kind of, for me, breaking the mold on what a Christian artist was. Yeah, even just for like what it means to be a girl in Christian music. She just was herself, and it didn't seem like she was trying to be someone else or fit something that they were trying to make her into. The vulnerability and honesty of her emotions that she was putting into those words, like, all came out in the music. And it was, I remember my friend JC and I just lay on her living room floor and JC's living room floor and just cry and listen to Jennifer Knapp because she was awesome. Even though they say we
have fallen. Well, she's one of the early people to ever come out in a very hostile world towards people coming out as gay. And obviously that was a really hard thing for her, but somehow she's held on to her Christian faith, even though it has evolved. And so for this second part of the Christian series, we were lucky enough to sit down and talk with Jennifer over Skype and see why she's still a Christian. It was a great conversation.
I am real mad that I wasn't on that conversation.
Well,
just not mad.
All right, well, welcome to the Liturgist Podcast, everybody.
Why am I still engaged in the space of Christianity? You know, I can't even begin to answer that for everybody else, but like, what keeps drawing me back? And the one thing I can say personally is that the way I engage Christianity now is wildly different than when I started. And like, to the point where even like how I began in the beginning seems like a mystery to me. Like, why did I drink that Kool-Aid is one of the things that I say.
Because you were in college, right?
Yeah, I was in college. I was pretty much on a 2-year bender. I hadn't been sober for a couple of years. And, you know, when I talk about how I entered into Christianity, the concept that I was a valuable human being, worth fighting for, worth living, that there was some kind of dignity that the divine saw in me, in my person, was a dramatic revelation to me. The why I continue is there has been some kind of truth in this process. I don't spell that with a capital T necessarily, and I don't necessarily link it to believing in particular things. Like, you know, Noah had to get on the ark and put all those, you know, the 2x2 on there. I think that's somewhat, for me, even to this day, fantastical. But underneath of that story of redemption and grace, and the participating in life with the care of the preciousness of that. That is something about the story and the narrative of Christianity that still compels me to this day.
When Jennifer, one of the darlings of Christian music in the late 90s, just dropped out of the game suddenly in 2002, it started a lot of rumors. And when she came out in 2010, there were a lot of angry and mean people. But somehow, she seemed to always speak with such grace and kindness, even to those who disagreed with her. In an interview with Vox, she said this about her detractors. "I really feel uncomfortable with the idea that someone not understanding me is my enemy, as opposed to someone who hasn't yet had the experience to be comfortable with other people who are different than they are."
I think one of the things that I've resisted along this way is to say that I get to throw the baby out with the bathwater if there's something meaningful that I can participate in with other people, a language that helps us look at the depth and the richness of our lives. I mean, Christianity is one way to do that. It's a spirituality and a religion that does that. We also do that in the way that we write, in the way that we tell stories. But there's something about that process that's immensely meaningful to my life. And it's something that I just keep pulling on the thread. Mm. Yeah. And I think even that's one way that I continue to engage, especially in American Christian culture. I think one of the decisions that I made was like, do I want to just simply be angry at this? Or do I want to say, yes, this has been a gift to me in some ways, and it's been a problem for me in others. So if I leave and I just simply, you know, abandon the process that has something in it that's meaningful to us, do I not give it a chance to even be redeemed? And I don't know if that makes sense, but it's, you know, I'm not necessarily out to be a card carrying Christian either. You know, I still struggle with being labeled as a Christian, because that, I think in this culture, people think that that means that I'm on side with Jerry Falwell, and I'm, you know, thank God I'm not. But at the same time, like, does that mean that I discredit somebody else's experience because it's going sideways for me? I don't know. I want to be part of that laboring toward how we process our lives spiritually, philosophically, and in real time contact with other people. I think there's something significant to that. Mm. I think when we lose that, we lose a little something of what it means to be human. Mm.
So do you go to church now?
When I have to. No, I mean, I'm not a member of any one particular church, and I don't necessarily prescribe to a particular denomination. So that kind of out of the way, I still am participating in faith-based communities. I do go into churches and speak a lot. I find new ways to connect. And I think that speaks something to a lot of people that I've talked with through the years, where we've had this experience inside of Christianity, but few of us are actually going to church. What I call the old-fashioned way, right? Sunday morning at 11 o'clock, and we go through the ritual and the rite. I think that raises an interesting question to me, is like, what is church and what does that look like? And how do we show that? It's something I've really had to struggle with, because I don't miss it, you know, in that sense. Like, there's nothing that I feel like I'm missing, because I'm connecting with other people who are giving me fruitful conversation and teaching me and sharing wisdom in other ways. So is that, you know, I question, you know, am I failing the church in some way by not participating in that? Or am I part of a movement that's trying to figure out what it means to have a spiritual practice in kind of a new place and a new time?
What's it been like for you in the music part of your work since you've come out?
Yeah, you know, I call this career 2.0, right? So I had 3 records that I did during my Christian music career. And then after I came out, you know, I knew that I was going to have, quote unquote, a secular performance future. But at the same time, I knew that I honestly wasn't really interested in participating in CCM. And part of the decision for me as an artist to kind of liberate myself from just talking about issues of faith actually helped me feel a lot freer to explore spirituality, you know, the undercurrent of life in ways that didn't feel as restrictive to me. Like in the former genre, there's an expectation that you'll talk specifically about Jesus and your relationship. You know, there's always this character of Jesus or of God in the conversation that has to be overt. So no matter where you start in the conversation, you have to put that being into the song and how you interact. It never felt like as an artist when I was writing that way that I got to be the center of it, or that a human being gets to be the center of it. It's just always in reaction or response. And in Career 2.0, where that's not necessarily my concern, the thing that surprised me is I realized that my theological thinking actually still shows up in the music that I write. It just doesn't have the religious language. And so early on when I started writing again, I found that I had to break myself of the habit of using the kinds of words that to me invoked Christianity. And so it challenged me as a writer to have to look for new ways of being able to say the things that I wanted to say without kind of triggering off for somebody else, but even for myself, this idea that I was trying to talk to you about religion. I didn't want to talk about religion. I wanted to talk about, you know, what it's like to be human. And when the spiritual shows up in that, that was kind of a gift. I was really surprised that shows up. And even like, strangely enough, the last record I released about a year ago, which I'll be touring this fall, it's called Love Comes Back Around. And when I was writing that record, I wanted to write a record that was kind of romantic and talked about what love is in its various forms. And I was so pissed off because I didn't really know where to start except for 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient. Love is kind. It keeps no record of the wrongs. And, you know, there's something quintessential about that that I wanted to tap into. And I think being free from feeling like that had to be, you know, in a religious context really helped me touch on some things that were intimate and truthful without having, you know, to feel like I was trying to conform to love in some way, but rather to let love be a gift.
Three of us here in this conversation have had complicated relationships with the specifically Christian music industry and what it's labeled, and what does it expect of us, and how do we fit what we're supposed to fit because we've sang about God, or because we've sang about these with this language and these metaphors and these ways of speaking about life and meaning and what it means to be human in ways that include Christian language. Now all of a sudden, yeah, are you in this camp? Are you in this group of people that makes music that is a sort of propaganda to make people turn into Christians, theoretically, or become more hardcore Christians or whatever? So as somebody who that kind of felt forced on me, I feel a very complicated relationship with the word Christian. The reason I asked you, Jennifer, whether you go to church, that's one of the main things that came up while Mike and I were talking. Like, I don't go to church anymore. I love a lot of the Christian, what I think of as metaphors and language. I think Christ, the teachings of Jesus, I love the ideas of like the cosmic Christ. There's so much in mystical Christianity's history that I am like, yes, 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 yes. Love St. Francis, love all that. But I'm curious about, Jennifer, you say you're not necessarily consider yourself a card-carrying Christian, but you're still in the story somehow. I just am curious. I would love to parse that story out a little bit more with all of us, even just a bit selfishly, because I don't call myself a Christian at this point. But it's not because I don't love Jesus or that I'm not interested in Christian theology even. I am very interested in continuing to talk about Christian theology. And when I go, I'll occasionally find myself in a church. It's not very often. But why would I call myself a Christian if I don't go to church? What is the is there some sort of tribal belonging? Is it a system of belief that I believe enough? I like the language enough to put myself in a box. So like the different, Mike calls himself a Christian.
Although most Christians don't call me a Christian.
But yeah, Mike goes to church. Mike loves going to church.
I love it so much.
Yeah. I don't love going to church very much.
Because you ain't going to the right churches.
I also love Comic-Con. I also love Harry Potter World at Universal. Like, I just love weird things.
See, and all the things that you mentioned, Mike, are things that I would run away from really fast. Like, the idea of going to a group setting, right? It's very rare, like my personality type. I don't actually crave these communal gatherings, which is really strange, I think, as a musician. I found a place to kind of enjoy what happens when people come together. I deeply appreciate that. At the same time, I also know that I'm a person that when I've experienced ritual over and over and over again, I know that I turn my brain off and I become desensitized, right, to the meaningfulness of a moment. Like, surprise works much better for me. And to use kind of a trendy Christian culture word, like, seeking is a much more meaningful experience for me rather than repeating something over and over again, hoping to manifest a feeling. But I'm in the same boat with you guys. Like, I think there's that rub that I have. Like, when I say I'm a Christian, on one hand, I know that there are people who, with the things that I definitely theologically believe, would say, oh, you're disqualified from being a Christian. And at the same time, it doesn't necessarily make me comfortable when I realize that there are people who pay attention to when I say that, that it's an endorsement of Christianity that, you know, right now troubles a lot of us. I've made a personal choice at some point to say that, you know, this is a starting place, and Christianity is the word that I use to talk about the tradition that has the language and has a tradition at which I begin with, but it's not necessarily like the end of where I'm at. Doubt from the stage or doubt on a microphone and going, man, I don't know if I believe in that, was enough to get you disqualified from ever working again. And now I've just kind of embraced that and say, well, I'm kind of working at it the way that I do. The concept of church being linked to Christianity has always been a troubling one for me. Because, you know, what happens if I'm not in church? Do I cease to be somebody who's looking toward the divine? And if I don't necessarily perfectly relate to Christianity, does that mean that other religions don't, you know, and other spiritual practices don't have the right or aren't in some way legitimate? Is a deeply troubling thought to me.
I do not see myself as a Christian. I once did, but with my current interpretation of spirituality, or the current expression of spirituality, Christianity just really does not cover it. I don't really see much value in the Bible currently, or at least for myself. Mostly makes me angry. I think there will come a day where I will be able to reassess the Bible and Christianity and maybe find beauty and connection to the divine through Christianity and Christian expression, but currently I find it very refreshing to fully distance myself from it.
I am a Christian because I have felt the Holy Spirit, and I truly believe I've felt God and His guidance in my life, and I believe that He created me as a beautiful human being.
I am a master's student of biblical studies, and I would say that I am not a Christian in any kind of philosophical or spiritual sense.
I had a professor tell me a few months ago that he likes to call himself a disciple of Christ rather than a Christian, and that really resonated with me.
The word Christian is literally just an adjective given to people of faith in the New Testament.
If you looked at each part of me and my religious identity, technically, yes, I would be a Christian, but I have a lot of trauma connected to the church and just general distaste for organized religion.
I am a person of faith. I am on this journey, but I'm also a very confused theologian, and I have dedicated my life to discovering what it really means to be a Christian.
I like to say yes, I'm a Christian in the sense of someone who follows the teachings of Jesus. But politically, I would want to distance myself just about as far as possible from the term Christian.
I still consider myself a Christian, not because I have a set of intellectual beliefs, I usually don't, but because I practice Christianity. I participate in the sacraments. I pray sometimes. I try to follow Christ's way.
I read the Bible, which honestly these days is not helping me much. And I try to make peace with my shaky belief in God as I figure out who God is.
It all depends on how you define what you mean by Christian. I've actually found it easier to say that I'm not a Christian or that I don't believe in anything rather than having to have these constant debates and arguments and discussions on what it means to be a Christian.
So we're in this space of where people don't know if they're Christians or not, and there's not a lot of spaces where that's okay. I feel like our culture has lots of spaces if you're like, oh yes, I'm definitely a Christian. And I also feel like we're creating spaces in culture for, oh, I'm definitely not a Christian. But if you're not sure, or if in some crazy way you're okay if people do or do not identify as Christians and are just interested in exploring and discussing spiritual ideas, even if you're not personally spiritual, there's not a lot of space for you. And that's why the Liturgist podcast exists.
And that's why our gatherings exist. We've from the beginning felt like when we come together from different perspectives, from different stories with different emphasis and different parts of the journey, all right there together in the mix in one big messy situation, it actually provides space for people to be who they are.
After every gathering we have, I leave feeling exhausted, but inspired and seen and part of something that's bigger than myself. And we've got a few more coming up before the end of the year.
So if you'd like to join us in a non-judgmental, communal, semi-spiritual experience, well, next week, October 5th and 6th, we'll be in London in the UK. Just in case you thought it was London,
that's
Georgia.
That's next week?
That's next week. We leave Wednesday. And then November 16th and 17th, we'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And on November 30th and December 1st, we'll be headed to Nashville, Tennessee. You can learn more and grab your tickets at theliturgistgathering.com. In London, we'll see you very soon.
Yeah, better look at a calendar.
Are you a Christian, William?
Yeah, I am. Though, just like you two and Mike as well, like I feel like I doubt and I question a lot. I'm also, like you said, Jennifer, very deeply concerned about the representation of what that means and whether the word evangelical or the word Christian means now. But I'm just of the belief that if the gospel can be used to oppress us, then it can be used to liberate us. So that is the only, I think, idea or thought that tethers me still to a type of formal belief in the Christian faith or even an understanding of Christian orthodoxy, so to speak, though I do think there's space to wrestle with what is orthodox, what is actually traditional, because it's a big history and it's a wide history. So yeah, I feel like a lot of what all of you feel with it complicated. I will say, growing up in the Black church, there was something about the music and the spirit of it all that still kind of lingers in my soul a bit. So when you said earlier, you're like, I don't go to church. And I was like, that's because you don't go to the right ones. Yeah. You know, like there's something still, like I'll still show up to a church and the choir and the music and the mood and the spirit of the room will still really deeply impact me. Or there have been times even in the last year where I've gone to church and they've like, you know, come up for prayer if your family member's sick, or we'll anoint you with oil. And that was a really powerful experience for me to go up there and get my head anointed with oil and to think of, you know, a family member that has cancer. I find those things deeply meaningful still, even if I can sit there and pick apart everything the pastor's saying, which I can. But yeah, so that keeps me, I stay enough around it to feel comfortable.
What did you mean by if the gospel can oppress us, it can liberate us?
I think historically speaking, the gospel has been used in our American cultural context as a type of slaveholder religion. The gospel was given to the African slaves as a way to suppress them, oppressed them emotionally, spiritually, and physically. And so when my ancestors was handed this religion, at least in the last several hundred years, I can't trace it back further. Mm-hmm. It was meant to be used for my detriment, to keep me submissive, to keep me quiet, to keep me part of the status quo. And so I think looking back at our history, realizing that when the slaves heard the story of Moses and the children of Israel, they saw a God who was looking for their liberation and their freedom. And I think that's traditionally, generally speaking, how historically speaking, how, you know, Black evangelicals have interpreted their faith as freedom being the ultimate ideal of God, that God wants freedom and he wants to break the backs of pharaohs and oppressors. And, you know, to the point of even sending plagues, that God cares about justice. I think that story is deeply moving for marginalized people to know that God is not just passive out there and just observing suffering, that he is engaged in it and willing to raise up deliverers for the sake of freedom. So for me, that's what I mean when I say the gospel, if it's been used to oppress us, it can be used to liberate us. Mm. And I think that was a hermeneutic that slaves naturally took a hold of without being taught, without being learned. So I agree with you, Jennifer, in terms of like your journey of trying to find maybe new language, new metaphors, and also a new hermeneutic for how to look at the text, how to engage with it, and, you know, just have a meaningful praxis, I guess, for how we live.
Yeah. Liberation. Gosh, that's the one thread I have never been able to kind of get away from that the gospel shares with me. Like, it's a completely radical idea to say to a human being, you are free. Hmm. I think for me, that was like early on, the appeal of the gospel was like, I was free. And what does that mean? I think maybe in that time, so to speak, like I could see a door opening up in front of me. Mm. And as I began to explore that in a lot of my music and in the way that I talk, I also found that as I spoke of that freedom going, man, you don't own me. Mm-hmm. You know, of all the forces that are external to me that I could name, like as a woman, I've experienced, you know, a certain amount of my culture saying, no, you can't do that. You're not allowed. You know, this is a place that you're supposed to stand. These are the times that you're allowed to speak was something I was just understanding something of the notion of what was in front of me. I would resist that. Going, no, I'm free. And then, you know, again, as a queer person inside of a faith community, that's like, no, you can't be this. And I would be, it just didn't make sense to me. No, I'm free. Mm. I've run into over the last 20 years, realizing that when I say that I am free is a really rebellious thing to say.
Yeah.
In our culture, because it terrifies people. If I use Paul as an example, say everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial. As a gay Christian, I think it's hilarious that I quote Paul at this point.
Paul's kind of an asshole. I mean, really.
Yeah. And, you know, I have problems with Paul. Like, Paul and I would go to the mattresses, you know. But there's something about that I find extremely intriguing, that I can do anything. Like, the possibility that's before me is anything. The question is, what is beneficial? And I think what Christianity inspires me to understand something about the extreme importance and significance of what we do with our freedom. How do I treat my life knowing that I can do anything? For example, on like a somewhat lighter end of things, you know, I had a church, it was like, alcohol's off the table. If Christians don't drink alcohol. And I was like, no, I can. But is that beneficial for me? I love scotch. I think it's a holy nectar. Mm. Whiskey and I love whiskey. But there's a certain point where when I remember that, the freedom that I have to be able to engage in that, I must ask myself, is that beneficial? And that is the part of talking about freedom, the blessing it is to have life and will that we've been bestowed, particularly if we look at it from a Christian viewpoint, you know, what do you do with human free will, right? If we're not just tethered to God and only blessed by God when we're doing exactly the conformist thing that God wants us to be, seems contradictory to this message of what it means to have freedom. And when you start to exercise that freedom, we consistently tend to hear, no matter where we do it, is, you know, you're going to cause damage to other people in your freedom. The challenge is that we do that. I mean, we can and we do have the power to hurt other people. You know, this concept, right, that we talk about often in the academic circles where the liberated turns to oppress the oppressor. Like, how do we stop this cycle is one that's immensely intriguing to me. And I don't want to give up on that challenge.
I love that you identified the feeling of threat, because just recently I had a friend. I was going to do a house show at this house, and my friend's parent basically said, "Oh, I don't want him to come because he's a threat." And it's funny because I think anyone who, I mean, the threat is right. It's your body. It's what you believe, who you surround yourself with, and what that does to, you know, people's ideas about the world or ideas about God. And I kind of had this funny moment where I said, you know what? They should be afraid. I am a threat. I am a threat. And I used to feel paralyzed by that, right? In church circles where people would assume like I'm a threat for whatever reason. Like, but now kind of in a funny way to, because of freedom, like you're saying, to go, you know what? I am a threat. I am dangerous. What I believe and can say and who I surround myself with will radically shift things, and that's okay. Now, how I use that freedom, how do I use that for the betterment of people and not just for the striking down of something or just being condescending? Like you said, and that's what still intrigues me about the gospel is the reality of, yeah, I am a threat. My body is a threat. My belief system is a threat, especially to existing power structures. Now, how do I help liberate myself and other people in a way that causes people to feel beloved and to feel part of the oneness?
Yeah, I'm really intrigued by like the concern that we're starting to hear in public discourse and conversation, right? I think we're doing a better job perhaps of being more aware of the power structures that are in play. And like we're talking about this, these notions of wanting to actually participate in society, but we become a threat because we're pushing against things that have actually damaged us in the past. And I don't know, it's strange to me that, you know, any time that somebody tries to solve a problem in our polarized culture right now, it still comes with a certain element of finger pointing. And I think that's a real challenge that we're facing, right? For those of us who are on a space of wanting to truthfully look at where power threatens our own liberation. And at the same time, understanding that I desperately want for my fellow human beings around me to know what liberation is. To know what it means to be loved, to have dignity, to be able to function in society, and to join with me in the fight against trying to say that the evils that we experience and that we recognize, I don't know if that I'm convinced that I have to kill every evil thing that I see, but rather I wonder sometimes if it's the nurturing something that appears to be evil back to health. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense to me.
But am I letting evil off? Then we start to engage in issues of justice, right? What does justice look like? And does justice have to be forcibly putting someone back into a position of rightness? It's an interesting thing that I sincerely wrestle with.
I think as a culture, we just struggle in general to tell the truth and to love. Meaning, can I tell you the truth about this right here in this moment or how I feel about this and still know that I'm loved, still know that I'm accepted? Even if I failed or even if you failed. And I think we dance between the pendulums of both of that. And so, like, I feel like we've been very anemic, actually, probably as a culture when it comes to justice or when it comes to liberation. And I feel like we're growing in that. We're gaining strength. And I think oftentimes it looks like we're doing it wrong. But I think that balancing between truth and love is very, very important. And I think people feel like they have to choose between the two. And I don't think you have to choose. I don't think any of us should have to choose. I think you should be able to communicate truth and always know that you can experience love, which by that I define as acceptance and belonging and safety.
It's interesting to me that you talked about truth and love. And one of the first things that I heard, it was kind of a trigger for me in a way, because how many times I've had somebody come up to me inside of the faith community and say, you know, I'm telling you this because I love you. You know, you need to not be gay anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And a myriad, you know, you're living in sin and God can't love you. And, you know, and on that conversation goes. But a distinction that I heard in the way that you said it is, it's a different way than I've heard it in the past, which is, you know, if I speak to you of the truth that I have with me, the earnestness of what I know, will you still love me? And that's particularly resonant to me because that's kind of where I feel like the movement for the LGBTQ inclusion has been. We're telling you our truth now. We're hoping that you will believe us. And that's the challenge to you, to know this truth about me and that you will still love me. That's a dramatic difference between I'm telling you the truth because I love you. That to me still goes back to the elements of what I have learned with the gospel, that here I am, I'm willing to stand before my deity in some way, the way that I am, and say, can you still love me this way? Because I felt like the answer has always been yes.
Yep.
And if there's something that I hope to religiously replicate, is that with everybody that I meet, right? To be able to say, wow, Mike, I can't believe you're into that. I might repeat back, is that beneficial? Like, talk to me about that. Tell me how that's beneficial for you. Not with a spirit of interrogation, but with a spirit of curiosity and knowing and figuring out how to find out what love is in your truth.
I'd love to talk about that with the the caveat that I am not evangelical anymore. Now I'm unvangelical. Like, nothing interests me less than convincing other people that their lives should be more like mine.
Right?
Nothing interests me less than convincing people that their faith should be like mine. But with that said, like, and this might sound triggering at first, so just preemptively assume I'm going a different way than these words will sound. But I actually believe at this point in my life that we are all living in sin. Being gay and being in a gay relationship doesn't happen to be one of those sins, but we are all living in sin. If the best and most compelling theological description I've ever heard of sin is a culpable disturbance of shalom. Culpable meaning like something you do or don't do. Disturbance meaning the lack of creation or the resistance of, and shalom being a state of wholeness and peace. And if shalom is that, and culpably disturbing shalom is sin, having any awareness of anthropomorphic climate change and not making an absolute and total reordering of your life immediately is a state of sinfulness. Because we are literally going to burn up the world, right? Like, and not in some distant 10,000 year timeline, like a few hundred years, potentially the globe is uninhabitable. And we all keep flying on airplanes and eating beef and running air conditioners and doing these things that provide us a little comfort to get through the day at the expense of other people. And so, like, and I listen to this conversation that we're having that's fascinating, and I hear so many things I resonate with, like, is the resurrection a thing? Did that really happen? That kind of sounds ridiculous to me. What is new life? What is freedom? And then I hear some people saying, like, I don't find that in church. And I get that because church has been such an institution of oppression and persecution and danger for so many people. But I didn't on accident compare the church to Comic-Con or to Harry Potter World at Universal, because at both Comic-Con and Harry Potter World, people come together in a social consciousness and use a collective imagination to make mythology real. When I walk down the streets of Diagon Alley in Orlando,
yes, God,
I am in the wizarding world. I can point a wand at a window and utter a magic phrase,
Expelliarmus,
and objects will respond to magic. When I walk around at Comic-Con and I see people dressed up as characters from beloved mythologies, I see my imagination walking around in flesh and in blood, I dare say incarnationally. And so when I contemplate the idea that at one point God took a physical body out of a tomb as a representation that it doesn't matter that we are born in sin, that we are evolved organisms that are innately wired to look after our own needs first, even if it comes at the expense of the other. An empty tomb says creation itself has a plan for that. And so the reason I like to go sing songs and take the Eucharist is so that my imagination that there is some other way, that there is some other story that leads to the redemption and not the destruction of creation, becomes real in that space. So I have a lot of caveats if I'm going to go to church. I don't go to churches that aren't affirming of all sexualities and gender identities. I don't go to churches that won't ordain women and queer people and have them in full and complete, not only membership, but leadership of the community. But I have to go to a place personally where the imagination becomes real. And then, like, there's this notion, is the church exclusive? If I go to a Christian church, am I saying that every Muslim and Buddhist and Hindu and Zen person and every non-religious person is in some fundamental way wrong about creation? And I think about John Philip Newell's beautiful image that when faith traditions are young, they are tiny saplings that have to be protected so they can grow. But once they are full-sized trees, they are meant to provide shade and comfort to all that come near them. And that no great tree is any better than one or the other. It simply matters which one is closest to you in proximity is a place that you can find comfort, care, and shelter. So I like really resonate with people who feel that they are in some way the church in exile or in the Christian diaspora. They can't walk through the doors of a church building anymore, but in some way are still fascinated with a story of resurrection as told by Christ, with the weird, strange teachings of Paul the Apostle, this mythology in the Hebrew Bible. All these things compel them, but they can't use the word Christian. I don't care. Because for me, I need a social collective imagination. Other people find liberation in silent contemplation alone. And whatever leads you to that liberation, to that freedom, to that imagination, that there is some way that humanity can be saved, is freedom, is the gospel, is the church. And I love it and I support it. And I consider any person who seeks a better tomorrow for everyone and not just themselves, my brother, my sister, my non-binary kin in this great tradition of faith. Sometimes we talk about things that are too weird for the Liturgist podcast.
Yeah, I mean, all the heavy-hitting topics, psychedelics,
earlobes,
sports,
things like that. If you're kind of longing for the first season, less structured, very conversational approach to the podcast, if you want to see what's happening behind the scenes before it happens, if you want access to weekly meditations that are guided by the folks who host the Liturgist podcast, we do all that over on Patreon, which is how the Liturgist podcast exists at all.
We don't do ads on this show, and part of that's because it's a niche, unique audience that would be hard to find the exact right ads for. But also, more importantly, we take this space very seriously, and we don't just want to throw anything into the space. We know that this is a safe place for a lot of you. And not only do we want to ruin the flow of the show, but we've never wanted to be tied down to corporate interests or people needing us to behave and stay in a certain box. And sometimes that just happens with advertising money. Something seems out of bounds. And we always want this place to be as open as possible. And for that reason, patrons are not just like icing on the cake for us to be able to make this happen. Patrons are absolutely necessary to this work because there's a lot of work, a lot of human hours involved and energy that simply could not and would not happen without the patrons. So we are so appreciative to all of you who financially make this show possible. But there's also another element of the patrons that we don't often talk about, and that is sort of the core community that they provide for the whole ethos and vibe of the liturgists as a whole. And even if you're not part of that community directly, it influences you if you're a listener to this podcast or anything that we make. There's sort of a core group of people that regularly talk together. There's people that get together. There's discussions that happen even after every podcast. We put a thread up on Patreon so that people can discuss it there with the other patrons. And it's always inspiring. There's so many wise, thoughtful, huge-hearted people that are part of the Patreon community. And that community really does influence everything we do as the liturgists. So if you're not a patron, but you love this show or anything that we do as the liturgists, we would love to invite you into our little community. For as little as $1 a month, you can be part of it. And it helps. It goes a long way. So go to theliturgists.com and just click the little join us button in the corner. And we'd love to have you join us. I've really enjoyed hearing all of you talk about freedom in different ways. It makes me think of even how freedom has changed for my life. And when I think about what I thought freedom was when I was 16, was that I wouldn't masturbate anymore. That was freedom.
And then, well,
and then,
I want to ask you how that worked out.
Got him.
All you got to do is turn 35. It takes care of itself. Yeah.
Speak for yourself.
Versus, and then at a point for me, becoming free was letting go of Christianity, letting go of my faith. That was the boxes. That was the chains for me. And then not too long after that, being okay with the religion again, was like the aversion to it were my chains. To be free to love Christianity, to be free to be able to go into a church without freaking out, without, as soon as I get home on my laptop and writing an angry blog post about it. So freedom has evolved for me. And that, the way I think about freedom now more, I'm probably more from like a Buddhist lens, where freedom from a small individual sense of separateness that results in suffering is kind of, when you say freedom, that's my immediate go-to, how I think about it. So it's interesting hearing all these different ways of talking about freedom. So I would just love to hear more from you, Jennifer, on like what those walls felt like, what it felt like to burst out, how freedom has evolved for you, and how does your faith continue to pull you into new realms of freedom?
Yeah, I resonate a lot with what you're saying. I think what I pull out from that is there are moments in time where we have different things that are binding us, right? So I would say that kind of like you were saying, like there are different kinds of bondages that I've experienced at different points in time in my life. You know, what is hindering me from having this full and abundant life, right? What fear is holding me back? What am I afraid of in front of me? Like that's been different at different times. Like when I was 18 or 19 years old, I just did not understand at all that I was a person of any worth. I just did not value myself, and it showed. I damaged myself. I hurt myself. And in the process of that, I just was leaving a trail of tears with other human beings as well. Think, you know, when I was in CCM music and was, you know, I left in 2002. I felt like the guitar was an oppression. I felt like Christianity was an oppression.
I felt like I couldn't measure up to the expectations that everyone wanted of me as a woman, as a performer, as a Christian, in a lot of other ways. And that just became so critical to binding me up that I didn't even know how to proceed. And I had to go away from that, recognizing that in some way. It felt like a loss and moving away from a lot of things. See, you know, I'd seemingly had success. I had a career. Musicians would love to have the career that I had. And I was like, I can't do this one more step. Like I wasn't a human being inside of this. I didn't know who I was. I was suicidal. I was every day I got up, I hated every person in the audience for being there and supporting me. You know, like I was just like, this is not good. This is really not good. And that fractured something in my spirit because I knew that something was awry. It wasn't earnest the way that I wanted to love myself or other people. Later on, it was in my hiatus during that 7 years, you know, I was trying to figure out how to untangle the knot that it all kind of, like everything in my life seemed like it was just one big thing. Like my Christianity was tied to my musicianship. My Christianity was tied to how I felt about myself. My sexual orientation was a factor that I was trying to contemplate. You know, and if I wasn't one thing, did that mean that these other things weren't valuable? I had to go through this whole process and I was just bound up. And kind of fast forwarding ahead, like the first move that I'd made, it was like, it was okay for me to walk away from the church or whatever. I stopped doing quiet times. I just stopped worrying about all the quote unquote things I was supposed to do to be a Christian. You know, I stopped trying to work on the profession of Christianity. And so I just said, you know, I'm just going to go be me. I want to, what does everybody else do? So I, you know, like I didn't think about church and religion anymore. It didn't mean that I stopped. Well, I was surprised because it turned out it didn't mean that I stopped thinking spiritually. It didn't mean that I stopped, you know, having a spiritual life. But it was a strange choice. I didn't know it then, but it was a liberation, like you were saying, like to be able to go, I don't have to do Christianity this way anymore. I just thought when I made that choice initially that it meant that I wasn't a Christian anymore. That kind of turned out not really to be true. Each one of those moments was a different point to engage in choosing freedom, to be able to look at that critical point and say, I know somewhere in the core of my soul that I am not meant to be bound. And what is the next move that I'm going to make? And I will turn toward and in the direction of freedom. You know, what I've been shocked by is by repeating this practice. And that's kind of what I think I've gained over the last 20 some odd years, is that I've had opportunities to recognize where I can enter into, and with faith and with hope, what freedom might be, and turn toward that and see if it repeats itself again. And I'm stunned every time. Like, so when I came out in 2010, you know, this is career suicide. And I'm like, well, I don't have anything else to lose. I haven't been working for 7 years. Nobody probably missed me. I'm dead in the water anyway. So why don't I turn back toward music and see what happens? Because I wanted that back. That belonged to me. Like, music is a gift in my life. Whether anybody listens or not, maybe I would have a career, maybe I wouldn't, but I wasn't going to be bound up by saying, oh, I can't play music anymore because I'm gay, or I can't play music anymore because I really don't want to engage with the church anymore with my music. I was like, no, I'm ignoring that. I'm turning back to this one thing here and seeing if by saying yes to hope and possibility that this will turn out to be the gift and life-giving, because it certainly was life, and that gift seemed absent without turning in that direction. So for me, that was what shocked me about that is this is a suicidal moment to be able to say, yeah, I'm gay. You guys are going to have to deal with it, and still claim my faith. There was a victory in that, even though that I knew that I was going to be losing the support, inviting people to say terribly wicked and destructive things. Strangely enough, like I just felt like it was the right time in the moment. It's like, oh, I know that that's going to come. So let's do that and see what happens next. On the other side of that threshold was connecting with people who were not only other LGBTQ people who were still engaged in their faith community, but were other people affirming that dignity in me and understanding, because they had done something similar, that understood the kind of courage that it took to turn and return to participating with other people, to turn back to the Comic-Cons and the Universal Studios and say, I want to be a part of what's going on here. And can I come in? And there is a place that has been there. You know, I found a reconnection. I love Henry Nouwen. He talks, I think it's From Loneliness to Solitude. I think that's the right name of the book. But he talks about the distinction between being, you know, lonely and as a difference from being in solitude, right? The regeneration in those singular spaces, those introverted spaces, which for me is brilliant. I would like to tell everyone that I'm an introvert and a hermit by nature. But what music has done as an example has been a gift in my life that's allowed me to return to other people. At some point, a song that I write in my room and by myself is deeply meaningful and a spiritual experience. But there's another level that takes when I begin to share it with other people. Mm. Then communion begins to happen. Connection with other people begin to happen. And then I start to understand that while, you know, the air in my lungs and the life that I have is a gift, and I can leave that, you know, I may be completely satisfied to live in a cave for the rest of my life, but there's an abundant life outside of that. And there's in connection with other people. So that's a strange thing about, kind of, to me, about cycling through these moments to be able to find liberation. It doesn't just happen individually. There's something mystical and amazing that happens when we're willing to enter back in with other people.
Man, I love what you were saying there, Jennifer. I mean, as a Buddhist-minded person, I'm not sure that I agree that freedom doesn't primarily happen in the individual's experience.
But I don't know that I would necessarily say that either. I don't know that I would say, like, there's an end requirement of it. I'll stand by that contestation, because even for me, I'm like, am I, for example, not a Christian because I'm not in an organized church? Like, there's something about that I'm like, yeah, I'm not buying that either. But I do think there's, like, as an example, like studies in solitary confinement, you know, it's really hard for an individual in a dark room to find a sense of their own identity without the social. Yeah. And I feel like there's something meaningful about that, that there is something there that seems to be true about having to connect with other human beings without seeing ourselves in some mirror or participating in some way. If we're not doing anything in the world, are we part of the world? It's a question that I'm willing to entertain that seems to hold true in some point, having to connect and share even the knowledge that you find alone with other people.
Are you conflating, though, the idea of freedom and personal identity? Is that one and the same?
That's a good question. I hope I'm not. You know,
I'm not trying to argue with you. I really love your perspective. I love so much about what you're saying, and I totally relate. Man, what you said about music pulling you out to other people is like, oh, that just really resonated with me. I love that and so relate to it.
Yeah, but it's a deeply personal thing to do that. I can get liberation from somebody else, right? You know, if I'm literally shackled, somebody else can come up and unlock the shackles and then thus liberate me. But in my mind, you know, what do we do about the metaphysical liberation? And I'm not sure that there's a way to do that that's incredibly lonely. It's, you know, a deeply personal experience. No one else can make you free if you don't believe and trust in your own freedom and invest in your own concept of that. So I don't know if that rescues the conflation at all. But, I mean, there's a certain point where I definitely go, you know, and it's been troubling to me in my religious life, was saying, valuing my own ability individually to contemplate the divine and what that means for freedom for me as an individual. I am assuming perhaps that somewhere in there's a second step to, with that liberation, then what is my responsibility now that I have it? How do I act in a free space with responsibility becomes maybe the next tier question for me.
I think it's all interrelated though, right? Like it would have to be, like, if we are mimicking creatures, right? Then you can't truly be an individual without the model, you know, for how to be, how to live, right? And so I'd imagine ultimately in our psyches and our sense of self, there is this interindividuality, right? Like we're not totally autonomous in and of ourselves, that we are connected to each other. We're interrelated to each other. And so everything that works out in the individual is a mirror of everything that works out in the collective. I don't even know if we can even divorce any of those ideas, like as creatures, as human creatures. So freedom then is ultimately, it is very it can be very personal, but that is also still a reflection of the collective freedom as well too. And so Christ ultimately to me as a symbol represents the individual and the collective. I think the image or the metaphor of Christ represents it perfectly. And that's probably why I'm a Christian, is because I think I see that image clearly compared to any other image or metaphor from any other religion. I see it very clearly in the person of Christ in terms of his humanity and his divinity and the incarnational reality of him. So to me, that question is answered in Christ. It sounds silly to say. You know, like, Christ answered that question for
that's
me.
That's answered in Christ, and we're all living in sin. These are the takeaways from the Liturgist podcast.
Hey, climate change is real. That's true.
Sociologists tend to view human cultures, one of the spectrums they use to evaluate them is how individualistic or collectivist the culture is.
Mm-hmm.
So America's a very individualistic country. Most of Europe is very individualistic. India, China, Brazil tend to be much more collective cultures. There's another spectrum that's recently been proposed about how tight or loose a culture is, but that has nothing to do with what I'm about to say, so I won't go into it.
Ooh, I'm interested.
It is super interesting because when you start taking cultures on multiple spectrums, you start giving really good predictors for how people in those societies will behave, what their moral codes are, what they approve, what they disapprove of, which leads me to my next point. There's no such thing as individual human consciousness. It doesn't exist. Yeah. And when we study the human animal, we are less collective than eusocial insects. So we have much more individual identity and survival capacity than, say, a solitary ant or bee. But compared to almost any other animal on the planet, we are more socially inclined and less capable of individualistic survival and psychological coping. The most introverted, solitary, hermit, human animals are way, way, way more collectivist than the average tiger. It's just, it's not close. And so, like, we can talk about, like, liberation, truth, all these theological components, but me being Science Mike, I always jump back and I go, well, those are navigating mythologies that humans use to cope. And there's a great book called Consciousness and the Social Brain. It's one of my favorites that goes into this social theory of human consciousness where basically if a person goes off by themselves, a little piece of a group consciousness carries off from the group and then immediately begins to degrade. And the longer that piece of the collective consciousness is removed, the more and more degraded and less healthy it becomes until it reemerges back into a social identity. And so what's interesting to me is if you look at Buddhism, Buddhism arose as a faith in a collectivist culture. So you see this movement towards finding truth within. In other words, we are all in each other's spaces and emotions and physical proximity constantly. And so you will find some freedom and some liberation on the other side of a sociological spectrum that you haven't experienced. At the same time, Europeans are basically stealing a Middle Eastern religion in an empire that is designed around the notion of the individual and autonomy. That's a very Greco-Roman concept. And so these Greco-Romans take on Christianity in conjunction with some Jewish diaspora, and then they say freedom is found in what? The body of Christ, the surrender of the individual. And so what I think, where we find truth and find liberation spiritually, the gift we get from these navigating mythologies is the capacity to take a click up in our view of the world beyond our indoctrinated cultural expectation. So I think that's why so many Americans encounter Buddhism and are like, wow, because they're in an individualistic culture that has had a strange collectivist faith be transformed back into the personal salvation narratives in this highly individual lens. And then Buddhism says, go in through the individual, which you as a Westerner are capable of. So that's no challenge for you. And then lose yourself. And then that's a big challenge for the American. Whereas perhaps for a Hindu to lose yourself, that's no challenge. That's the easy part. Maybe the challenge in that culture is just go into yourself. I guess I'm using science to be a peacemaker to say, according to science, you're all right looking at a different facet of human biological behavior.
Absolutely.
Also, we don't have free will. Lol.
What?
Well, I would say, okay, so individual consciousness is not a thing. I agree on the fundamental level. You couldn't say that collective consciousness is a thing any more than you could say, because you take all human civilization, collective consciousness, that's rooted in the ecology of the earth and in the food that we're eating and in the, and that's rooted in the orbit of our planet around the sun. And
fair enough.
So there's no, you can't ever draw a firm line around this is the real thing that's happening as its own thing. It's all connected to all of it. And to me, I said that the experience of Buddhism can be more individualistic. I was referring to that look into yourself practice as opposed to like come to church and take the body and blood with everybody else. The real freedom, and while I agree that the idea of freedom and truth and all these things are coping mechanisms, like you said, Mike, I don't agree that the experience of them is necessary. I don't, maybe you didn't mean it like that, but I wouldn't say that the experience of them directly is a coping mechanism. The experience of freedom is a different fundamental experience than an experience of bondage. There's an I that is limited, that I can't do something. That to me is the feeling of bondage. And at this point with my experience, it's a tricky thing to talk about freedom sometimes, because when somebody feels like there is something else that is real, that is chaining you as though that's a real thing, it's difficult and not appropriate to say to that person that that's not true. And I have enough love and compassion for the people that are believing their stories to not like try to dismiss it. But I also firsthand know what freedom is now, and that we are all free at any given moment. You are free. And I think Jennifer said earlier in the conversation, it's a radical thing to tell that to somebody. It is a radical thing to say you are free, because if they don't feel free, if they feel like somebody else is not allowing them to be free, if they feel like something themselves is not allowing them to be free, it can be threatening, it can sound offensive and is offensive. But who do you think you are? And that's to me, the ultimate, when you get down to like, oh, all these lines start dissolving if you really look into them too closely. Who do you think you are? You're God holding on to a story and getting esoteric.
I was about to say, I'm a little lost right now.
Yeah,
I am not lost. I'm actually laughing because I'm the one who identifies as a Christian expressing a materialistic atheist worldview. And you're the one who doesn't identify as a Christian who's talking about the validity of the idea of God. It's just kind of hilarious. Because I literally wrote down bondage and liberation are parts of a story that brains tell. Rocks never feel free or in bondage.
Unless you believe Romans 8 that says all creation is groaning and waiting for the liberation, right? Maybe they are in bondage.
I believe it when I take the Eucharist at Comic-Con. Sorry, Jennifer. I don't know if you were prepared for how deeply weird we are.
I don't think she was.
No, actually, I'm enjoying listening. This feels like the conversations that I get to at a bar over a beer so many nights.
Yes.
And loving the conversation I'm in. I'm like, man, we should record this.
Isn't that how this started, right? From a bar, right?
Literally.
I had a little wondering. So Christianity, we would often say, right, that like it's very, we used to say like very individualistic, but it's communal in the gathering. Just politically speaking for a moment, would it be far-fetched to say that Because I think a critique typically of evangelical Christians are how they're not, they don't have a collective sense of like, we are like, as Americans, we're all one, right? They kind of seem to isolate themselves and like, you know, but it's interesting because it almost feels like to me that if you are a diehard Christian, your sense of collective identity comes from just church alone. They see themselves collectively as a whole, the Christian faith. Like when there was a billboard here in LA that got taken down, some people complained. It was Greg Laurie holding a Bible and, I don't know, saying, come to my Crusader church, right? And he's like a big, you know, the Harvest guy. He like fills out stadiums in Orange County, right? Whatever. And people complained about it. They took the billboard down. Within a day, I think any Christian like that I saw on my feed on Facebook was like, this is a disgrace, you know, whatever. When it comes to any other social issue, they're not saying anything. But when it came to like that one, it was like, you know, they were on 10. It was like, I think it even got Fox News coverage, right? Like, but so many other collectivist issues don't get like raised in that. So do you think the problem is that American Christianity sees itself as the whole instead of a part of a greater whole?
That's a big problem.
And that would be the fundamental disconnect of what we're seeing.
Say that again. When American Christianity sees itself as the whole and not part of the whole, is that what you said?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like they see themselves as a whole unto themselves. And so their issues, their concerns are the world to them. Nothing like really else.
Well, the Christian story is that the church is the center of God's work in the universe.
Yes.
So the universe revolves around the church.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so climate change, oh well.
You know, when I left in 2002, like kind of did my initial, you know, screw Christianity, see you, good night. What I did was, not long after that, I traveled Europe for a good while. And Europe's full of really great cathedrals, great religious, you know, European religious history. So I found myself in a lot of cathedrals. I went and saw the Book of Kells. And almost every time that I was in some of these spaces, I was somewhat being cynical as I'm going and like, look at all this old crap. But at the same time, I think one of the things that started to dawn on me is that I feel rather ignorant when I say this, but it had never occurred to me that I'd grown up in an American Christian culture, that that the Christianity that I had experienced was cultural, right? That it had the markings of regionally where I grew up. And, you know, I hadn't kind of burst the evangelical bubble yet, because in the way that I had experienced Christianity, there, you know, Christianity was evangelicalism. That's all to say is that, you know, I've had the privilege of being able to experience and witness so many different kinds of Christians. You know, I used to think there were California Christians back in the day. Because,
that's so, I mean, real. Sorry. That's like, that really is a thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was shocked. Like, I remember you mentioned a Harvest Crusades, right? So I participated with Harvest Crusades back in the day in the early 2000s or so. And I was shocked because I was weirded out by the wealth of a lot of the mega churches in California. I'd never
really Orange County too.
Anything like that. Harley Davidson motorcycles and people who drank wine. And in the South, that's not on. Like, you just did not openly drink wine. And so I said, I had this perspective that there was a progressive nature to the Christians in California that were different. In the Northeast, you know, I experienced them as rather, and these are all stereotypes, right? So they're not necessarily what I captively think today. But, you know, I'd experienced a more academic approach to Christianity from the North. Then in the Midwest, it was, the way I grew up was just everybody was Christian. So what's the big deal? You know, so all these kinds of different ways that even within the U.S., I'd already had an experience as a musician that I hadn't really thought about that, and given credit to the different ways that people practice this tradition, that it wasn't just one thing, even though the narrative that comes out of America is kind of tying into that "What Would Jesus Do" movement and everybody's got the t-shirt and buying into the brand. That's the perspective, you know, the experience that I thought that I was having. But once I got outside of that, spent some time out of the country, and I later lived in Australia for 5 years, where you don't hear the mention of Christianity nearly as often as you hear it in the States. And you don't realize that the frequency at which people talk about Christianity in the States is dramatically different than some other Western countries. So that concept of that, you know, there was a way that was culturally happening here that strangely recognizing that for me was like, oh, wow. Like, yeah, some people do Christianity this way, but what is the same? You know, what is the common thread between what I've experienced in the U.S. Northeast, the South, the Midwest, the West Coast versus Europe versus Australia, you know, versus other places that I've been. And I think that was part of the rebuilding process for me, and not just saying you couldn't just stereotype a Christian. But if you've never seen that and you hadn't had that experience, or you only read from whatever the local Christian bookstore gives you, and you only listen to the kind of music that, you know, the brand that you buy into, right? If you're only a Fox News listener, you're going to only get that narrative. And challenging ourselves with other narratives actually helps us see, I think, is, you know, one of these conversations of diversity. Why diversity matters is it gives us perspectives that we don't get to experience necessarily ourselves and in our place and in our time.
Yeah. Hmm. Kurt Anderson, who wrote a book recently called Fantasyland, and he talks about how the problem with America is how overly religious we are, and that's kind of core to America. It's the hyper-individualism, like, you know, you can do whatever you want to, believe whoever you want to. And he was saying that pretty much has led to who we see in the White House. Because it's not an aberration. It's actually like deeply part of the American spirit. Like you're saying, is the cultural lens by which we're overly fanatics. And we see the world through a certain lens. And so therefore, because we're overly religious, we then impose that myth and that fantasy and not just want to live in that bubble, but then, you know, want everyone else to do the same. And it's funny, growing up in America, you don't realize that's the core sin, really. You know, I was thinking about that driving over here. I was like, man, I grew up overly religious. Like, when you're in church 4 days a week, that's overly religious. You know what I'm saying? Like,
there's a qualifying number for days per week.
Three is borderline, four is overly.
I was going to say, I think that's interesting, though, that, you know, that's the assertion, right? That we're overly religious when church attendance is actually dropping at an exponential rate in the States. Mm-hmm. Like, what does that actually translate to? Is there another way of, because we definitely talk about religion, right? And faith and these things matter, but none of us here are like, you know, go to church more than, you know, a few times. So how does that actually manifest?
I think that might be the post-evangelical crowd or the nons, the N-O-Ns. But I think the parts of Christianity that are still, like, I think they're actually getting like more religious. Like, they're not loosening up in a major way. Maybe millennials might be. That's a question. White millennials are, yeah.
Are what, becoming more religious?
Less religious, equally spiritual. Americans of color are not abandoning church in any significant numbers.
Black Christians are not leaving the faith in any type of...
Hispanic and Latinx Christians as well.
Yep.
Even among millennials, see no significant decline.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a white people problem.
Right. The big, much vaunted death of the church is really just the death rattle of white Christianity, which is awesome, I personally think. Let that one go.
Yeah.
Fade quietly into the night. Like that... Whatever that speech is, do not go gently into the night. No, white Christianity, go gently into the night. Just shh, shh. We're going to give you a couple more shots here. You're going to feel real sleepy.
Are you sure this isn't a heretical podcast?
Oh, it is definitely.
Yeah.
I want to set up a testimonial page of major Christian faith leaders denouncing us. My personal favorite is when Ken Ham said that we were more dangerous to the Christian faith than atheism. So, yes.
Wow.
Because there's a gray.
Yes.
Seriously. Gray is more threatening than atheism to them. Mm.
If Jesus was brown and the church is brown, I got no problem with that, personally.
I don't either, but I will say, just to be self-critical, I do think there are parts of the Latin church and the Black church that have pulled from the white church and are deeply... There are parts of the Black church that are deeply unhealthy. They're a part of... the Latin community in the religious tradition that are just, you know, that because that's who was the biggest, right? Like, everyone pulled from TBN. Everyone was pulling from, you know, the famous white preachers. Like, that's where, so there's that wrestle there. Like, Black spirituality or Black Christianity is not perfect. Also complicit.
The decolonizing movement of Christianity led by Christians of color.
Yes.
That's why I'm so for that and so excited about it. If they can hold on to the liberation aspects
yeah.
of the church and hold on to these things that create this beautiful social cohesion and this collective care for one another, and then ditch
white
all
theology.
The hyper-individualistic colonized components that Europeans and Americans indoctrinated into those communities. That would be a really beautiful faith.
It would.
And I just offer a quick translation to those who aren't following the same people on Twitter that we might be following.
were we speaking in code?
That's a good point.
Wait.
These guys are not talking about skin color. They're talking about systems of power, systems of oppression that have existed and normalized themselves through centuries, and not that white people, as people that have light skin, are somehow inferior. This was not an anti-light colored skin speech that you were hearing from them.
That might have got a little insider. So I would say it this way. I love white people.
I love white people too.
I love white people. I'm out to get whiteness as a sociological construct of systems.
And identity.
And
too.
Identity, yes. I'm attacking whiteness,
the
which
identity
is held
itself.
By many
yeah.
white people.
Yes, yes.
But some people of color.
Engage in whiteness.
Omarosa, super white. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Very true. But,
back on the tracks, folks.
You guys do have the ability to edit, right?
We do.
Oh, yeah. I'd run all that personally.
I didn't mean to imply anything. I'm just... Yeah, I might need to do a blurb about the views expressed in this podcast by the liturgist are not necessarily those held by the guest. No.
Well, thanks for joining us and dealing with the madness today.
And thank you for your life and your work and for being courageous and leading the way for untold numbers of people in the future that want to follow Jesus but also have identities that are sometimes not acceptable to their world, to their tribe. And you just, I think you're a hero to a lot of people, and just thank you for being courageous and being you.
This has been part two of our series called Christian. We want to thank Jennifer Knapp for joining us this week.
Thanks to Greg Nordine for production assistance. If you like the music on this podcast, make sure to check out On Earth. We just came out with our second volume of music. A lot of it was from this podcast, On Earth Volume 2. Check that out.
And we want to thank our hosts, William Matthews, Michael Conger, and me, Science Mike.
Thanks for listening, everybody.